Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome.
Welcome to the Bard's Grove. This is your hostess, Cass.
And Lantern. We want to welcome you to another evening's entertainment, storytelling from long ago, brought to your ears tonight. How have you been, Kat?
Oh, I've been good. A little bit of a cold, but otherwise okay. How are you, Lantern?
All real good. We have a wonderful, seasonable, cool spell out here on the coast, and it's a lovely autumn evening. Sure enjoyed that full moon yesterday.
Yes, the full moon was beautiful. I especially loved it because I am a Taurus, and so the full moon was in Taurus. It was usually every year at this time, the full moons are quite intense because, of course, the sun in Scorpio is the time when we have to release what's dead. And a lot of times we walk around carrying dead parts of ourselves that we just don't know what to do with. And at the Scorpio full moon, we get to look at that Taurus moon and say, what do I value? What's important? Taurus is all about beauty and relationship and good stewardship of the earth. And it's about the sensual pleasures of life. But it's also about what do we think is most important. And so it's beautiful. It's a beautiful symbolism, this full moon, because as we let go of the things that are dead, we can serve the things that are important. So it's like those things become the seeds that we take into the future that we want in our lives. So each year we get a chance to let go of the things we've done and used and been that we don't want to be anymore. We've finished with that part of our life. And we get to bring forward into the next year those things that still carry importance for us.
That's wonderful. It was an absolute beautiful full moon, and I enjoyed it tremendously.
Did you see Jupiter up there next to it?
I sure did, shining away.
Yes. Yes, it's quite beautiful and lucky when Jupiter's there. Speaking of luck, today is 11-11-11. What do you think about that?
Well, I know that all the Kabbalists I know are counting on it. and of course, you could also say, I'll be one with that.
That's good. I just find it so fascinating that how the human psyche needs to see patterns and things and make stories up. And in some ways, not that I'm for or against some of the things that went on today, you know, the meditation. I meditated. There was a group meditation at 11 o'clock in the morning, wherever you are, or 11 at night, wherever you are, about opening portals to higher dimensions. But once again, as an astrologer, I would say it's a cultural marker, not a celestial marker, because, of course, our calendar, our Western calendar, was changed in the 1500s, and other people have different calendars. So the fact that we're at November 11th, 2011, 11-11-11, isn't necessarily a cosmic marker, let's say, but it's interesting. It's interesting how people have taken it and run. Are you one of the people, Lantern, that would look at the clock, now that we all had digital clocks, of course, and see 11-11 on the clock a lot?
No, I didn't have a chance. I was committing education today.
No, I'm talking about through your life. Are you one of those people that through your life you've noticed that, oh, look, it's 11-11?
No, I'm more of a number nine person. I tend to see nines a lot.
Oh, great!
And as a Virgo, and as a person who spends a lot of time in studies, I have a strong relationship to what in the greater Attu of the tarot deck is called the Hermit.
Yes,
the Lantern Bearer. So these are things and spirits and numbers that move me greatly, and tend to sync up with my life. 11 in tarot, the contemporary tarot, is thought of as lust, meaning not so much carnal lust or sexual lust as that desire to learn, to study, to be more, to do more, the next thing, never enough. The saying is, be hungrier than the shark.
Right. It's also lust or strength. It's also the taming of the emotions, which leads you into the inner journey, if you will.
Sure.
A lot of the tarot up until the 10, which is fate, it's about the outer journey. And then after the 10, you start to go into the inner world. And in some of the older decks, like the Rider-Waite deck, you have the woman closing the mouth of the lion rather than the masculine journey, which seems to be kill the lion. And so psychologically, we often think of the masculine journey like Hercules. Well, I have to kill the lion of my passions. Whereas the feminine, all the ancient goddesses, well, we have Sekhmet, the lion-headed goddess of Egypt, but all of the ancient goddesses always had lionesses pulling their chariots. So there's this whole idea of strength or lust, as Crowley called it in his deck, too. You know, the ability to tame the emotional life and not be so, unconscious about what emotions you're feeling, but being able to direct them and direct your desire. So that's also interesting. A friend of mine, a cousin of mine, as a matter of fact, I wrote a little article for astrology.com. They asked me to write one on 11-11-11, and I talked about it's very calendrical, but it's the idea of making patterns or stories, and the 11 is a master number. It's about, you know, incarnating spirit, and 3 is about the number of process and how you work things out in time. But, you know, so I made it very spiritual. I said, no matter what it means, it's this opportunity to open to spirit. And my cousin wrote me and said, what's the matter with you? You're in Las Vegas. Don't you know that 11 is a lucky number when you're shooting crowds? And I didn't. So I missed out on that. But so today is supposed to be a lucky day. And, of course, I brought that up, too, because Jupiter is the planet of luck. And it's, and for those of you who right now are not under a cloudy sky, which is what we have here, if you look up at the moon and you'll see Jupiter, which is getting further away from the moon now that the moon's traveling, but it's a lucky time, let's say. So everyone, I hope you're putting your intentions out and trying your luck in one form or another. Well, listen, Lantern, how would you, I'm sure you have a wonderful story to tell us tonight. We're still in that Scorpio kind of death and rebirth place. What do you have tonight for us?
Well, I have a story about a death and a rebirth, and it's a mission to go find the 3 golden hairs of Dede Svesvata. He's an embodiment of the sun. So here we go. The 3 golden hairs of the old man, Dede Svedavada. Can this be a true story? It's said that once there was a king who was exceedingly fond of hunting the wild beasts in his forests. One day, he followed a stag so far and so long that he lost his way. Alone, overtaken by night, he was glad to find himself near a small thatched cottage in which lived a charcoal burner. "Will you kindly show me the way to the high road? You shall be handsomely rewarded." "I would, willingly," said the charcoal burner. "But God is going to send my wife a little child, and I cannot leave her alone. Will you pass the night under our roof? There is a truss of sweet hay in the loft where you may rest, and tomorrow morning I will be your guide." Now, the king accepted the invitation and went to bed in the loft. Shortly after, a son was born to the charcoal burner's wife. the king could not sleep. At midnight, he heard noises in the house, and looking through a crack in the flooring, he saw the charcoal burner asleep, his wife in a faint. And by the side of the newly born babe, three old women, dressed in white, each holding a lighted taper in her hand, and all talking together. Now these were the three sodiche, or fates, you must know. The first said, "On this boy I bestow the gift of confronting great danger." The second said, "I bestow the power of happily escaping all these dangers and of living to a good old age." And the third said, "I bestow on him for wife the princess born at the selfsame hour as he, and daughter of the very king sleeping above in the loft." At these words, the lights went out, and silence reigned around. Now the king was greatly troubled and wondered exceedingly. He felt as if he had received a sword thrust in the chest. He lay awake all night, thinking how to prevent the words of the fates from coming true. With the first glimmer of morning light, the baby began to cry. The charcoal burner, on going over to it, found that his wife was dead. "Poor little orphan," he said sadly, "what will become of thee without a mother's care?"
"Confide the child to me," said the king. "I will look after it. He shall be well provided for. You shall be given a sum of money large enough to keep you without having to burn charcoal."
Oh, the poor man gladly agreed, and the king went away, promising to send someone for the child. The queen and the courtiers thought it would be an agreeable surprise for the king to hear that a charming little princess had been born on the night he was away. But instead of being pleased, he frowned, and calling one of the servants, said to him, "Go to the charcoal burner's cottage in the forest, and give the man this purse in exchange for the newborn infant. On your way back, drown the child. See well that he is drowned, for if he should in any way escape, you yourself shall suffer in his place." The servant was given the child in a basket, and on reaching the center of a narrow bridge that stretched across a wide and deep river, he threw both the basket and the baby into the water.
"A prosperous journey to you, my son-in-law," said the king on hearing his servant's story, for he fully believed that the child was drowned. But it was far from being the case. The little one was floating happily in a basket cradle and slumbering sweetly as if his mother had sung him to sleep. Now it happened that a fisherman, who was mending his nets before his cottage door, saw the basket floating down the river. He jumped at once into his boat, picked up the basket, and ran to tell his wife the good news.
"Look," he said, "you've always longed for a son. Here is a beautiful little boy the river has sent us."
The woman was delighted, and took the infant and loved it as her own child. They named him Plavacek, the floater, because he had come to them floating on the water. The river flowed on. Years passed away. The little baby grew into a handsome youth. In all the villages round, there were none to compare with him. Now, it happened that one summer day the king was riding unattended, and the heat being very, very great, he reined in his horse before the fisherman's door to ask for a drink of water. Plavacek brought the water. The king looked at him attentively, and then turning to the fisherman said, "That's a good-looking boy. Is he your son?"
"He is, and he isn't," said the fisherman.
"I found him when he was quite a tiny baby, floating down the stream in a basket. So we adopted him and brought him up as our own son."
The king turned as pale as death, for he guessed that he was the same child he had ordered to be drowned. Then, recovering himself, he got down from his horse and said,
"I want a trusty messenger to take a letter to the palace. Could you send him with it?"
"With pleasure, Your Majesty. You may be sure of a safe delivery," said the fisherman. Thereupon, the king wrote to the queen as follows.
"A man who brings you this letter is the most dangerous of all my enemies. Have his head cut off at once, no delay, no pity. He must be executed before my return. Such is my will and pleasure."
This he carefully folded, sealed with the royal seal. Plavacek took the letter and set off immediately for the palace. But the forest through which he tried to pass was so large, the trees so thick, that he missed the path and was overtaken by darkness before the journey was nearly over. In the midst of his trouble, he met an old woman who said,
"Where are you going, Plavacek? Where are you going?"
"I am the bearer of a letter from the king to the queen, but I must have missed a path to the palace. Could you, good mother, put me on the right road?"
"Impossible today, my child. It is getting dark, and you would not have time to get there. Stay with me tonight. You will not be with strangers, for I am your godmother."
Plavacek agreed. Thereupon, they entered a pretty little cottage that seemed suddenly to sink into the earth. Now, while he slept, the old woman changed his letter for another. The new letter said, "Immediately upon the receipt of this letter, introduce the bearer to the princess, our daughter. I have chosen this young man as my son-in-law, and it's my wish they should be married before my return to the palace. Such is my pleasure." The letter was duly delivered, and when the queen read it, she ordered everything to be prepared for the wedding. Both she and her daughter greatly enjoyed Plavacek's society, and nothing disturbed the happiness of the newly married pair. Within a few days, the king returned, and on hearing what had taken place, was very angry with the queen.
"But you expressly bade me have the wedding before your return. Come, read your letter again. Here it is," she said.
He closely examined the letter, the paper, the handwriting, the seal, all were undoubtedly his. He then called his son-in-law and questioned him about his journey. Plavacek heard nothing. He told how he had lost his way, how he'd passed the night in a cottage in the forest.
"What was the old woman like?" asked the king.
From Plavacek's description, the king knew it was the very same who, 20 years before, had foretold the marriage of the princess with the charcoal burner's son. After some minutes, though, the king said,
"What's done is done, but you will not become my son-in-law so easily. No, no, faith. As a wedding present, you must bring me 3 golden hairs from the head of Dere Svede."
In this way, he thought to get rid of his son-in-law, whose very presence was distasteful to him. The young fellow took leave of his wife and set off. "I know not which way to go," he said to himself, "but my godmother, the witch, will surely help me." But he found his way easily enough. He walked on and on for a very long time over mountains and valleys and rivers until he reached the shore of the Black Sea. There, he found a boat and a boatman. "May God bless you, old boatman," he said. "And you too, my young traveler. Whither are you going?" "To Dede Svedvere Castle with the three golden hares." "Ah, then you are very welcome. For a long, weary while, I have been waiting for such a messenger as you. I have been ferrying passengers across these 20 years, and not one of them has done anything to help me. If you will promise to ask Dede Svedvere when I shall be released from my toil, I will row you across now." Plavacek promised, and was rowed to the opposite bank. He continued his journey on foot until he came in sight of a large town hall in ruins, near which was passing a funeral procession. The king of that country was following his father's coffin, and the tears ran down his cheeks. "May God comfort you in your distress," said Plavacek. "Thank you, good traveler. Where are you going?" "To the house of Dede Svedvere, in quest of three of his golden hairs." "To the house of Dede Svedvere, indeed. What a pity you did not come sooner. We have long been expecting just such a messenger as you. Come and see me by and by." When Plavacek presented himself at court, the king said to him, "We understand you are on your way to the house of Dede Svedvere. Now, we have an apple tree here that bears the fruit of everlasting youth. One of these apples eaten by a man, even though he be dying, will cure him and make him young again. For the last 20 years, neither fruit nor flower has been found on our tree. Will you ask Dede Svedvere the cause of that?" "That I will, with pleasure," he said. Then Plavacek continued his journey, and as he went, he came to a large and beautiful city where all was sad and silent. Now the gate was an old man who leaned on a stick and walked with great difficulty, very slowly. "May God bless you, good old man." "And you too, my handsome young traveler. Where are you going?" "To Dede Svedvere's palace in search of three of his golden hairs." "And you are the very messenger I have so long waited for. Allow me to take you to my master, the king." On their arrival at the palace, the king said, "I hear you are ambassador to Dede Svedvere. We here have a well, the water of which renews itself. So wonderful are its benefits that invalids are immediately cured on drinking it, while just a few drops, even sprinkled on a corpse, will bring it back to life again. For the past 20 years, this well has remained dry. And if you will ask old Dede Svedvere how the flow of water may be restored, I will reward you royally." Plavacek promised to do so and was dismissed with good wishes. He then traveled through the deep, dark forest, in the midst of which could be seen a large meadow. Out of it grew lovely flowers, and in the center stood a castle built of gold. It was the home of Dede Svedvere. So beautiful with light was it that it seemed to be built of fire. When he entered, there was no one there, just an old woman at her spinning wheel.
"Greetings, Plavacek. I am well pleased to see you," she said.
She was his godmother, who had given him shelter in her cottage when he was the bearer of the king's letter.
"Tell me what brings you here from such a distance," she went on.
"The king would not have me for his son-in-law unless I first got him three golden hairs from the head of Dede Svedvere, so he sent me here to fetch them."
The fate laughed. did it, Svetveta, indeed. Why, I am his mother. It is the shining sun himself. He is a child at morning time, a grown man at midday, a decrepit old man looking as if he'd lived 100 years at eventide. But I will see that you have 3 hairs from his head. I am not your godmother for nothing. And at the same, you must not remain here. My son is a good lad, but when he comes home, he's hungry, and he would probably order you to be roasted for his supper. Now I will turn this empty bucket upside down, and you shall hide underneath it. Plavacek begged the fate to obtain from Dede Svetvere the answers to 3 questions he had been asked. I will do so certainly, but you must listen to what he says. Suddenly, a blast of wind howled round the palace, and the sun entered by a western window. He was an old man with golden hair.
I smell human flesh, cried he. I'm sure of it. Mother, you have someone here.
Star of the day, she replied. Whom could I have here that you would not see sooner than I? The fact that it's your daily journeys, the scent of human flesh is always with you, so when you come home in the evening, it clings to you still. The old man said nothing and sat down to his supper. When he had finished, he laid his golden head on the fate's lap and went to sleep. Then she pulled out a hair and threw it on the ground. It fell with a metallic sound, like the vibration of a guitar string.
What do you want, mother? Asked he.
Nothing, my son. I was sleeping and had a strange dream.
What was it, mother?
I thought I was in a place where there was a well, and the well was fed from a spring, the water of which cured all diseases. Even the dying were restored to health by drinking the water, and the dead who were sprinkled with it came to life again. But for the last 20 years the well ran dry. What must be done to restore the flow?
Oh, that is very simple. A frog has lodged itself in the opening of the spring, and it prevents the flow of water. Kill the frog, and the water will return to the well.
He slept well again, and the old woman pulled out another golden hair and threw it on the ground.
Mother? Mother, what do you want?
Nothing, my son, nothing. I was just dreaming. And in my dream I saw a large town, the name of which I've forgotten. And there was an apple tree, the fruit of which had the power to make the old young again. A single apple eaten by an old man would restore him the vigor and freshness of youth. For 20 years the tree has not borne fruit. What can be done to make it fruitful?
The means are not difficult. A snake has hidden among the roots. It destroys the sap. Kill the snake, transplant the tree, and the fruit will grow as before.
He again fell asleep. And once again, the old woman pulled out another golden hair.
Now look here, mother. Why will you not let me sleep? Asked the old man, really vexed. And he would have got up.
Lie down, my darling son. Do not disturb yourself. I'm sorry I awoke you, but I've had a very strange dream. It seemed that I saw a boatman in the shores of the Black Sea, and he complained that he'd been toiling at the ferry for 20 years without anyone coming to take his place. And for how much longer must the poor old man continue to row?
He is a silly fellow. He has but to place the oars in the hands of the first comer and jump ashore. Whoever receives the oars will replace him as the ferryman. But leave me in peace now, mother, and do not wake me again. I have to rise very early and must first dry the eyes of a princess. The poor thing spends all night weeping for her husband, who has been sent by the king to get 3 of my golden hairs.
The next morning, the wind whistled around Dede Svedvere's palace, and instead of an old man, a beautiful child with a golden hair awoke on the old woman's lap. It was the glorious sun. He bade her goodbye and flew out the eastern window. The old woman turned up the bucket and said to Blavacek, "Look here. Here are the three golden hairs. Now you know the answer to each of your questions. May God direct you and send you a prosperous journey. You'll not see me again, for you will have no further need of me." He thanked her gratefully and left. On arriving at the town with a dried up well, he was questioned by the king as to what news he brought. "Have the well carefully cleaned out," he said. "Kill the frog that obstructs the spring, and the wonderful water will flow again." The king did as he was advised and rejoiced to see the water flowing again. He gave Plavacek 20 swan-white horses and as much gold and silver as he could carry. On reaching the second town and being asked by the king what news he had, he replied, "Excellent. One could not wish for better. Dig up your apple tree, kill the snake that lies among the roots, transplant the tree, and it will produce apples like those of its former times." And all turned out just as he had said, for no sooner was the tree replanted than it was covered with blossoms that gave it the appearance of a sea of roses. The delighted king gave him 20 raven black horses, laden with as much wealth as they could carry. He then journeyed to the shores of the Black Sea. There, the boatman questioned him as to what news he had brought respecting his release. Plavacek first crossed with his 24 horses to the opposite bank, and then replied that the boatman might gain his freedom by placing the oars in the hands of the next traveler who wished to be ferried across. Plavacek's royal father-in-law could not believe his eyes when he saw Dede Svedvere's three golden hairs. And as for the princess, his young wife, she wept tears, but of joy, not sadness, to see her dear one again. And she said to him, "How did you get such splendid horses and so much wealth, dear husband?" And he answered her, "All this represents the price paid for the weariness of spirit I have felt. It's ready money for the hardships endured and the services given. Thus, I showed one king how to regain possession of the apples of youth. To another, I told the secret of reopening the spring of water that gives health and life." "Apples of youth, water of life," interrupted the king. "I will certainly go and find these treasures for myself. Ah, what joy! Having eaten of these apples, I shall become young again. Having drunk of the water of immortality, I shall live forever." And he started off in search of these treasures. And he's not returned yet. And that's the story of the three golden hairs of Dede Svedvere, an old Slovak fable. How's Bravo. That, Kat?
Bravo, very good. Very good. So what made you enjoy that story? What was the part that you liked the best?
Well, I always like stories that place a hero in search of wonderful gifts. And he's a hero not because he undertakes the journey, but because of the spirit that he takes with him on his journey. He's asked for help by people who he passes through, and of course, being a hero, he agrees to help all on his path. And I'm a firm believer that when you offer help to strangers on the road, when you give those gifts that you can offer to those people along your path, that you'll be rewarded over and over what you've undertaken. So
yes. Most definitely. I always love to see the tasks, and they're usually to restore health to the land, or to bring, you know, the apple is the fruit of Venus. So to bring love back and immortality, it's not that we want to live forever, but we want to have the juiciness of life back. And that's what the hero does. He brings back the possibility of renewed good life.
And the other thing that I liked about this, because I am very much a student of the light, a student of the sun, I like the fact that his task is to retrieve 3 golden hairs of the sun. And I also like the fact that in this story, the sun, his life in the day of being a babe in the morning, a full-grown man at the midday, and an old man at night, speaks to that cyclical nature of time. And I think it draws the parallel, the humanization of the universe, its echo in the lives of men and women on the earth. So there's just so much to enjoy in this.
Yes, and beautifully told, beautifully told.
Thank you so much. And what treasures do you bring tonight?
Well, in keeping with the theme of Scorpio, a lot of times, you know, we're descending into the darkness, at least here in the Northern Hemisphere. The light is growing stronger. As one of my favorite authors, Susan Cooper, once wrote a book, The Dark is Rising. The dark is rising right now, but we don't have to make it be that the dark is evil. But so many different people have seen the darkness as evil. So anyway, I'd like to do another story from The Caravan of Dreams by Indra Shah. It's called The Prince of Darkness. Once upon a time in the city of Damascus, there lived a goldsmith. He made items of jewelry so fine that his fame spread even to the ears of Iblis, the evil one. The goldsmith was sitting in his shop one day finishing the wings of a golden butterfly when he saw the dark-visaged evil one looking through the window. "Allah, have mercy on me," cried the goldsmith. "Has my last hour come?" The door opened as if pushed by invisible hands, and the tall black-robed figure entered. The evil one smiled and said, "Good fellow, fear not. I've not come for you. I was merely looking at your wonderful handiwork. I have heard, even in the lower regions, of your exquisite craftsmanship. I would like to have some samples. Shall we say the few pieces you have there in the window?" "Why, yes, yes, certainly. You can take all you please," said the goldsmith willingly. He was so glad the evil one was going to spare him that he would have given anything. "Look, I'll wrap them up for you and you can take them with you at once. There is a jeweled bear and a golden fish with ruby eyes and a necklace fit for a..." No, said the evil one. I don't want them now. I'll come back for them another time. Keep all that there is in the window for me, even though I may be years in returning. Will you promise?" I promise, said the goldsmith, very happy. And the evil one vanished. "Who was that you were talking to?" asked the goldsmith's wife, bringing her husband a glass of sherbet. "Oh, my dear, it was none other than Iblis, that accursed prince of darkness himself. He made me promise to keep everything which I have in the window for him, which he'll come back to collect one day when he's ready. Though I grieve for my beautiful pieces of handiwork, I am grateful, thank you, merciful Allah, that he has not carried me off to the underworld." "Everything in the window?" That's what the evil one said, yes. At that moment, the woman clasped her hands to her head and began to weep. "Alas, alas, our child was playing in the window, and that means the evil one means to take her too when he comes back," she said. Oh, the goldsmith rushed to take a look, and there, sure enough, there was his little daughter innocently playing with the golden toys which her father had put there. "Quick, wife," he said, "go to the goldsmith and bring me an ounce of virgin silver." His wife did as she was bid and brought back the silver, crying, still crying in her handkerchief. while the goldsmith went to his workshop and, taking the Holy Quran from the shelf, read the throne verse from it. And then he hammered out the silver thinnest paper and engraved a talisman for his daughter to wear around her neck. For he knew that a charm was most potent if worked in silver. And he told his daughter that she must never take off the talisman, or Iblis, the evil one, would carry her away. Well, years passed, and still the evil one did not come back. So the goldsmith and his wife had almost forgotten about the matter when suddenly the evil one appeared again at his shop. "I have come for my treasures, as you promised," said the evil one. "And the girl must now be about 17, is she not?" "Yes, yes," said the goldsmith, but change your mind, almighty Iblis, about our daughter, for she is the only child of our old age. I beg you, please, please spare her. Take me instead. I am beyond the pleasures of life, but she is still young. Take me, O great prince of darkness." "No, no, 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 no. I couldn't possibly do that," said the evil one, dashing aside the beautiful golden figures which the goldsmith was trying to shove into his hands. I want her especially." Well, so the goldsmith sent the servant to ask his daughter to come, as she was required urgently. Now the girl, whose name was Zora, was taking a bath, and in her haste to do her father's bidding, she forgot to put on her talisman. When she dressed, she ran to the shop, but there was something about the tall, dark stranger with her father which made her shrink away from him. "Zora, my child," said the goldsmith, "this is Iblis, the mighty ruler of the lower regions, who has come to take you away with him." Thinking that his daughter was protected by the silver talisman, the goldsmith continued, "But as you have your talisman around your neck, you need not go, so do not have any fear." "What?" cried the evil one. "How dare you try to trick me? I will not be robbed like this." And he reached out his hand to grasp the girl's clothing, but she ran away so quickly that her veil was left in his claw-like fingers. Zora ran as fast as her feet would carry her and found her talisman beside the bath. She put it on, and so was protected from the evil one immediately. Iblis gave a cry of rage and said to the goldsmith, "All right, I am going now, but I will be back for your daughter in 7 days. Mark my word." And he vanished to make certain arrangements with his fiends. Now, the goldsmith thought of a plan, and it was this: that he would make a waxen model of his daughter and conceal a machine inside the body, so that it could talk and walk like a human being. He worked secretly in the cellar for 7 days and 7 nights until he had made a perfect replica of his daughter, so complete that even her mother could hardly tell the difference. Then, having sent the girl away to her aunt's house in a nearby village, the goldsmith awaited his diabolical visitor. Sure enough, as he was sitting in his workshop, the evil one appeared once more and said, "Bring your daughter to me this instant, old man, without her talisman, or I will set my fiends to burn your house down. I'm in no mood to be trifled with at this moment." The blacksmith put his hand behind the curtains which led to the woman's apartments and said, "Zora, my child, come out at once, for the mighty Iblis, prince of darkness, has come for you." When she heard her husband's words, the goldsmith's wife turned the key in the back of the beautiful life-size doll and arranged a rose-pink veil around its head. "I hear and obey, father," she said in a gentle voice, and parted the curtains, giving the doll a push, and then she hid herself and waited. Well, you can imagine, the goldsmith held his breath as he saw the lovely creature glide into the room. When Iblis, the evil one, glimpsed the shrouded figure, he called, "Come to me now, beautiful mortal, so that I may take you with me to my wonderful kingdom of darkness. There you shall be my queen of eternal night." He pulled off the pink veil and saw a pair of modestly lowered lashes. The voice of the doll murmured softly, "I hear and obey, prince of darkness." And so the evil one snatched the image up in his arms and bore it away to the lower regions. Now, that night there was a great feast in the kingdom of everlasting fire, For Iblis had previously instructed his minions to prepare everything of the finest for that night's entertainment. The food was wonderful, the wine was perfect, the music was gay. But unfortunately, the fire was just a little too hot. While the evil one was sitting and drinking merrily on his ebony throne, the wax maiden started to melt, and she fell into the flames. The model was devoured in an instant. The thieves were aghast and leant on their pitchforks, wondering how their devilish master was going to take his loss. To their great relief, he cried out, "Well, these humans are a fragile lot. That wretched girl had only been with us a short while. What chance had she of lasting down here as my bride for eternity? I was mistaken. Build up the fire." And the party got merrier and the wine flowed while the great fire crackled louder than ever before. The feast went on far into the night, and the evil one never thought of Zara, the goldsmith's daughter, ever again. And that is the story of the Prince of Darkness. So I love these stories that come to us, especially the religious overtones of how we've seen the darkness and how we see the evil one. And obviously, the evil one is quite careless. He wants things, but he really doesn't pay attention to them, does he?
No, I thought that was a wonderful story. And you told it very well.
Thank you. There's something about evil that is very careless, I find. The whole idea of evil, there's a cruelty and a carelessness in violence and what we might consider evil that sort of brings about its own downfall. That's what I like about these stories. They tell us, you know, yes, evil feels like it's all powerful, but really it contains within it the roots of its own destruction come about.
Well, you know, I mean, it seems to me that one of the virtues of good or one of the virtues of right behavior is that you marshal your resources, you respect your resources, you tread lightly on the planet, you have respect for the world and for the people around you, which is the opposite of that.
Right.
So there's that distinction shown to us in these stories, these legends.
Yeah.
That evil is profligate. And is destructive and careless.
It is, because in a way the father is careless too, without looking to see what's there. He's so overwhelmed with fear that he's careless about what is important to him. Because of the overwhelming fear, he doesn't pay attention. And so he's in danger of losing the thing that's most precious to him. And that's the theme in very many ways, once again, of this full moon that we've just gone by. Not that the darkness and death is evil, because it certainly is not. But as I said, our religious traditions have seen it as evil. But the whole idea that how careless we are of the beauty of our earth and the things that we own and our possessions. And so it's really important for us to pay attention to what's precious in life and make sure that we don't go selling it off out of fear or out of a fear of the evil ones, if you will.
Absolutely.
So do you have another story for us, Lantern?
I do. I do. I have a very unusual story. We tend to think of death as a villain or a terror or as a thief in the night, as it were. But this is a very, very different story. This is an old Slovak fable called Godmother Death. There was a man, very poor in the world's goods, whose wife presented him with a baby boy. No one was willing to stand sponsor because the family was so very poor. The father said to himself, "Dear Lord, I am so poor that no one is willing to be at my service in this matter. I will take the baby, I'll go, and I'll ask the first person I meet to act as sponsor. And if I don't meet anybody, perhaps the sexton will help me." He went, and on the road he met Death. but he didn't know what manner of person she was. She was a handsome woman, like any other woman. He saw her. He asked her to be the baby's godmother. She didn't make any excuse and immediately saluted him as parent of her godchild. She took the baby in her arms, carried him to the church, and the little lad was properly christened. When they came out of the church, the child's father took the godmother to an inn. He wanted to give her a little treat as godmother. But she said to him, "Gossip, leave this alone and come with me to my abode." She took him with her to her apartment, which was handsomely furnished. Afterward, she conducted him into great vaults. And through these vaults, they went right into the underworld, the deep heart of the earth. There, tapers were burning of three sizes, small, large, and middle size. And those which were not yet alight were very large. The godmother said to the godchild's father, "Look, gossip, here I have the duration of everybody's life." The child's father gazed and looked, and he saw a little tiny taper very close to the ground and said, "Who's that? But gossip, I pray you, whose is this little taper close to the ground? Well, that's yours. And when any taper whatsoever burns down, I must go for that man. Can't you give me a little more time?" She said, "Gossip, I cannot do that." Afterwards, she went and lighted a large new taper for the baby boy whom they had just christened. Meanwhile, while the godmother was not looking, the child's father took for himself a large new taper. He lit it and placed it where his little tiny taper was burning down. The godmother looked round at him and said, "Gossip, you ought not have done that to me. But if you've given yourself additional lifetime, you have done so. Go ahead, possess it. Let us go from thence, and we'll go to your wife." She took a present and went with the child's father and the child to the mother. She arrived, placed the boy on his mother's bed, asked her how she was, whether she'd had any pain. The mother confided her many griefs to her, and the father sent for some beer, and they wanted to entertain her in his cottage as godmother in order to gratify and show his gratitude. They drank and feasted together. Afterwards, the godmother said to her godchild's father, "Gossip, you are so poor that no one but myself would be at your service in this matter. But never mind. You shall bear me in memory. You will go to the houses of various respectable people and make them ill. And you shall be physic and cure them. I will tell you all the remedies. I possess them all, and everyone will be glad to recompense you well. Only observe this. When I stand at anyone's feet, you can be of assistance to every such person. But if I stand at anybody's head, do not attempt to aid him." And it came to pass. The child's father went from patient to patient, where the godmother caused illness, and benefited everyone. All at once he became a distinguished physician. A prince was dying. Nay, he had breathed his last. Nevertheless, they sent for the physician. He came and began to anoint him with salves and give him his powders, and did him good. When he had restored him to health, they paid him well, without asking how much they were indebted. Again, a count was dying. They sent for the physician. The physician came. However, death was standing behind the bed at his head. The physician cried, "It's a bad case, but we'll give it a try." He summoned the servants and ordered them to turn the bed around so the patient's feet were toward death, and began to anoint him with the salves and administer powders, and did her good. The count paid him as much as he could to carry away without ever asking how much. He was only too glad that he'd restored to health. But when death came to meet the physician, she said to him, "Gossip, If this occurs to you again, don't play me that trick anymore. True, you've done him good, but only for a while. I must nonetheless take him off, whether he's due. The child's father went on his way for many years. He was now very old, but at last he was wearied, and he asked Death herself to take him. Death was unable to take him because he'd given himself a long additional taper. She was obliged to wait until it burned out. One day, he drove to a certain patient to restore him to health, and did so. Afterwards, Death revealed herself to him and rode with him in his carriage. She began to tickle him and play with him and tap him with a green twig under the throat. He threw himself into her lap and went off for the last sleep. Death laid him in the carriage and took herself off. They found the physician lying dead in the carriage and conveyed him home. The whole town and all the villagers lamented. That physician is much to be regretted. When a good doctor he was a great assistance, and there will never be another in his like. His son remained after him, but had not the same skill. The son went on one day to church, and his godmother met him. She asked him, "My dear son, how are you?" He said to her, "Not all alike, so long as I had what my dad saved up for me. It's well with me, but after that, Lord God knows what will be with me." The godmother said, "Well, my son, fear not. I am your christening mama. I helped your father to what he had and will give you, too, a livelihood. You shall go to a physician as a pupil, and you shall be more skillful than he. Only you must behave nicely." After this, she anointed him the salve over the ears and conducted him to a physician. The physician didn't know what manner of lady she was and what sort of son she'd brought him for instruction. The lady enjoined the son to behave nicely and requested the physician to instruct him well and bring him to a good position. Then she took leave of him and departed. The physician and the lad went together to gather herbs, and each herb cried out to the pupil and what remedial virtue it had, and the pupil gathered it in. The physician also gathered herbs, but knew not with regard to any herb what remedial virtue it possessed. The pupil's herbs were beneficial in every way. The physician said to the pupil, "You are cleverer than I, for I diagnose, no one comes to me. But you know herbs to counter every disease. Do you know what? Let's join partnership, and I will give my doctor's diploma up to you, and be your assistant, and be willing to be with you until death." The lad was successful in doctoring and curing, and his taper burned a long time. And there we go.
Very nice. Tricking death. I don't know. People seem to not want to die. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that for believers who know that when they finish their time here, there's other adventures, I think death has no terror.
I think so too.
And with that, my dear Kat, I want to wish you a bountiful journey.
A wonderful week, you too. And good luck to everyone. Luck is something that we can call to us, I think. And since we're in a lucky number today and seems to be a lucky time, we'll wish everyone good luck.
Merry meet.
And merry part.
And merry
meet again.
Again. So long from the Bard's Grove. This is Lantern.
This is Kat.
Bon voyage, my friends.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
We'll see you next week, same time, same place at the Bard's Grove.